Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. You can find him on Twitter at HMacBE. Welcome back to the show, Hilliard.
It's a great pleasure to be on.
Hilliard, the Bank of Canada has just done a systemic review. And what is it telling us?
So this is a review they do. It's called a financial system review, and they do it in, as a check on the resilience and the safety of the financial system of Canada, which is lenders, which is 90% is the big banks, and then there's some other lenders like Home Capital and Equitable Bank and other entities, credit unions, that sort of thing, but it's mostly the big banks. And they look at the risks. They say, well, if there's going to be a recession, could this happen? Or if there's going to be interest rate hikes, could this happen? Or if the price of a house goes down by more than 20%, could this happen? And I've been reading these for quite a few years now, since the first edition of the book came out 7 years ago. And this latest one, which just came out a couple of days ago, It sounds much more dire in the terms of the warnings. They always have warnings, but it's always kind of like, well, in this remote case of this unlikely possibility, we might, there might be a problem kind of thing. But in this one, it's more immediate. Like, you're talking about a dire warning about something that could happen or is already happening. And one of the things they mentioned, for instance, which I've never seen them mention before, is if somebody puts a 20% down payment to buy a home, of course, then they don't need mortgage insurance. And often they get that 20% down payment from the bank of mom and dad, or maybe they're not supposed to do this, but a lot of them borrow the money from an alternative lender, like the loan shark or something. Because there's no insurance on that loan, the bank would be at risk if the house dropped more than 20% in value, which some of the suburbs of Toronto has already happened. And the home buyers, say the young couple, if there was a recession and they lost one of them or both of them lost their jobs, then it would start to become a risk for the banks. So traditionally, the banks have considered those loans to be very low risk, because 20% cushion was always considered to be a much bigger cushion than, or I should say, in recent years, it's been considered a much bigger cushion than could ever get them into trouble. But in this financial system review, the Bank of Canada highlights it as a potential problem. And they say, so right now we've got a downturn in the housing market, we've got a downturn in the stock market, but the one thing we don't have is a recession. So that would be the trigger. And they talk about in this report about an exogenous, economists are always talking about exogenous events. So there was something that comes from Mars or some other planet and hits us in Canada here and causes us to go into a recession. But whatever it might be, if there's a recession on top of higher interest rates, a lot of these home buyers were barely able to qualify for the mortgage interest payments on those loans, then it could put the financial system into trouble. And that came out a few days ago. And then just recently, the earnings on the banks have come out just yesterday and today, late this week. And there's been some disappointments there. So the stock prices of the Canadian banks have gone down Well, on Thursday they were down 2 or 3% after some disappointing results from the earnings reports, primarily caused by higher interest expenses and mildly higher provisions for credit losses.
Yeah, I think the Royal Bank profit was down 14%, but still well over $3 billion for the first quarter.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, so, I don't know, $3 billion to some people may not be enough money, but for most it would be, I would think.
Yeah, the company is, these are not the exact numbers, but this is roughly the scale. The company's got an equity, on the balance sheet equity of $70 billion, let's say, and is trading for almost double that, say $130 billion. So if they make $12 billion a year, $3 billion times four, they're trading at only 10 times earnings, which is pretty good for a normal company. But in the banking world, that's actually that's pretty normal. Normally, you would never get a company for 10 times earnings. So we'd have to pay 20 or 30 times earnings. But with banks, they can be lower than 10 times earnings. But the better metric with banks is the multiple or the premium to bank book equity. And this is one of the highest in the world. The Royal and TD, several of the Canadian banks are trading at close to 2 times book value. So that's a warning sign. But it's been like that for a number of years. So it's not like all of a sudden this has happened. It's because people were very impressed by the Canadian bank's ability to make obscene amounts of money without ever losing any money, unlike the U.S. banks we saw last month, that several of them had to be rescued and or bankrupted, and trouble that we often see in Europe. The Canadian banking system has kind of sailed through all those kind of difficulties that everybody else has had without any trouble, but or with not any major trouble. And but the premium is, people are going to start looking at that premium and say, wait a minute, that's a pretty big premium considering that they have a potential risk in the housing sector. And, of course, the housing sector risk, it spills over into other sectors because people that are desperately trying to hang on to that home, even though they've lost all their equity, a 20% down payment is gone, or if they took the CMHC insurance, the insurance premium is wiped out all their equity long ago, they still try to hang on to the home because where are they going to go? And what they have to do is cut back on cars, car purchases, vacations, restaurant purchases, Canadian Tire expenditures, all that kind of stuff, discretionary spending. And that can be very hard on an economy. I'm talking about something that might happen in Canada. It hasn't happened yet. But it was interesting because the Bank of Canada did a stress test for something like this. They actually did two different stress tests in the last 3 years, and they indicated that they didn't expect that any bank would lose any money on mortgages because mortgages are solid. Everybody pays their mortgage without any trouble. That's the belief anyway, but the banks collectively could lose as much as $100 billion based on all those other things, credit card defaults, car loans, car repossessions, all the other lending, the commercial lending, the business lending, the office tower lending, all the other things that the banks do as people retrench and try to hang on to their homes. So that would wipe out a lot of the equity capital in the banking system. $100 billion is a lot, even for organizations as big as the Canadian banks.
Now, G7 personal debt. Canadians have the highest personal debt of any of the G7 nations. Most of it mortgages. Is that really debt or enforced savings? Some people look at it that way.
Yeah, it's debt because you think at it, look at it from the point of view of the lender, the bank. It's an asset to the bank, and it's basically just a piece of paper that says, "I, the young couple who just got married, are promising to pay you over the next 25 or 30 years $3,000 a month. Come hell or high water, we'll pay every month. And as long as we have a job, and as long as nothing else bad happens, and so that's pretty solid. Like in the history of Canada, that's been a pretty solid bet. So that asset is to the bank is highly prized, but it is an obligation. It's not savings; it's an obligation. The only savings that would be coming out of that would be if the house price went up, and then the young couple started to build equity in that home, which has happened for decades in Canada. Yeah. Like it's, last 23 years, houses on average in Canada have gone up 4.5-fold, and in some places like Toronto, is even more than that, so 5.5 times. So people that bought 23 years ago, so say that 30-year couple is now 53 years old. They've built up a massive amount of equity. Even if they borrowed 100% of the original cost of the house, they've now got a house with, say, 80% equity. So that's a forced savings plan for sure. But it only worked because it wasn't because they dutifully made their $3,000 a month payment. That's not the big thing there. The big thing is that the house price went up. That's the big thing. So if the house price is flat, or if it goes down, like it has been for the last, year and a half or so, then that savings plan doesn't work anymore. It destroys the savings plan. And the only time we had it where those savings plans didn't work were, I mentioned 23 years ago, 2000. Well, between 1990 and 2000, it went in reverse, and people lost money in their homes for 10 years. So those people paying that $3,000 a month payment, they had less equity in 2000 than they started out with in 1990, 10 years of feeding the money pit, so to speak, with no savings to show for it, right? So it entirely depends on if the house prices generally are going up or if they're going down. And of course, anybody in Canada that's listening to this is thinking, well, house prices never go down, they only go up, right? So and that's been true for so long now that people really do not believe that house prices can go down. And if they do go down, it's only temporary, like in some of those suburbs of Toronto where the house prices went down as much as 30%. People really don't believe that they're going to stay down 30%. They just think, well, it's a temporary thing. It's going to bounce.
Well,
right
in
back.
British Columbia, 100,000 people a year move to the province. They got to put them somewhere.
Yeah. Every province says that people are moving to the province. It's like, well, where are they coming from? I mean, the biggest component of outlawed immigration, as it's called, is temporary foreign students. Mm. And the second biggest component is temporary foreign workers. And they have a visa for 1 or 2 years maximum. So they have to be housed, but are they really going to sign up for 30-year mortgages payments, as we usually in this example of, if they get a job, if they get permanent status, if they get Canadian citizenship, if they can afford it, they may eventually buy a house. And and a lot of them, certainly it is true, but that's their dream, is to get the Canadian citizenship and buy a house. You don't actually need, you just need permanent residency.
Yeah.
You don't need citizenship. But we'll see if if house prices start going down, then you'll see that a lot of those people that are coming as temporary foreign workers or temporary students who might have bought a house, like temporary foreign students in Vancouver a few years ago were highlighted as buying houses. One of them bought a house that was worth $40 million or something, temporary foreign students. But that's pretty rare, I think. So that was obviously not the student, but somebody backing the student, probably the parents.
Yeah, and
but,
somebody knocked on their door and they said they didn't know what their dad did.
Yeah, they never know what.
But dad gave him enough money for a $40 million estate.
Yeah, I what does your dad do? Oh, I don't know what he does. I think he's some kind of investor. I'm not sure. Sort of like that. So, anyway.
Yeah, if I told you, he might have to shoot me.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I mean, those people that are doing that is obviously, moving money from a country like China into Canada as a safe haven for that money. You never know what's going to happen with the Chinese government and all that sort of stuff. But if house prices are going down rather than up, then that money stops coming. It's, you know, the people like that, the hot money people, are very sensitive to the trends. And
a way around the foreign buyer tax and so on. Well, FinTrack doesn't ask where the mortgage came from, so you take out a mortgage with X, default on the mortgage, they take over your property. There. They've acquired Canadian property and didn't have to buy the foreign, you know, if X is a foreign entity, they don't have to pay the foreign buyer's tax.
Exactly. There's a lot of ways around it. So until they get that that registry, that corporate registry of all the titles of who owns what, and tracing it all the way back to the individual shareholders of those corporations and the trusts and all that, it'll be pretty easy to get around the rules.
Now, Canadian small business is in big trouble. The Donnelly Group, which owns bars and restaurants across Canada, most of them, I think, in the Vancouver area, but in Toronto as well, they owe $20 million. First, the pandemic, where bars were closed, and then when they reopened, they could only partially reopen, and they have trouble finding staff now. Now, they had deep pockets, but they're having trouble surviving. What's the outlook for small business across Canada?
Well, you know, I think that hospitality business is, like we talked a minute ago about the mortgage problem and the housing problem, and it's absolutely true that people will do anything to hang on to their house. They'll let their car be repossessed before they skip a mortgage payment. So restaurants are vulnerable in that kind of a downturn. And I mentioned at the beginning, I'll say it again, we haven't officially entered a recession, but there are some signs, and there's several people, some of the ones you've interviewed, that say we might already be in a recession. I don't know. It's hard to tell. You never know till months after the fact that whether you've entered a recession or not. But it certainly takes money out of buying power for restaurants and travel and all those discretionary things that people do. Put that new deck on the house or whatever. Buy a car. They hunker down. I mean, they said that CIBC said something like 30 or 35% of all their mortgage holders are unable to make their payments on their variable rate mortgages if the mortgage payment was adjusted to the current rates. So now everybody's struggling with what to do with those people. And one of the possibilities is to amortize the loan out to 70, 80 years. You know, and that way the mortgage payments can stay the same. But of course, that person will never be able to own that home. Unless the interest rates come back down again and they can start making extra payments, or if they get a better job where they're paid more work and they can put more of it against there. But it's definitely not conducive for a small business if they're dependent on the Canadian consumer. A lot of small businesses are, then it's going to be a difficult time. I'm shocked. You know, I'm really surprised at how well that business has held up, because my experience, just personal experience, it's not any kind of scientific survey, is that restaurant prices have gone way up, way up. It's like, I've been shocked at the bills that I see, and I don't know if it's gouging or if it's cost related or what it is, but and then they expect you to put a tip on top of that as well, right? So nowadays, the thing when you go to sign that, when you go to scan your card, it's sort of the minimum, the lowest tip option starts at 20% and it goes up from there. I don't know what happened to 10% as long. I guess I'm revealing my age here, but anyway, I don't know. Like, I guess if they can get people to pay those prices, maybe they can survive some of them, but I don't think that people can pay those prices for very long. In the U.S., the mortgage business is different in the U.S. In Canada, the generally the longest rate you can get fixed is 5 years, and a lot of the variable rates are not even fixed for that long. In the U.S., most of the mortgage rates are 30 years, so the lender has to pick a rate that's good for 30 years, and the borrower, the home purchaser, gets to lock in that rate. Well, now they're up over, they hit 6% not that long ago, and now some of them are starting to be over 7%. So that takes just literally hundreds of thousands of people if not millions of people in the U.S. out of the housing market. They can't buy a house unless house prices come down quite substantially. They wouldn't be able to buy a house with 7% 30-year mortgage. And so that would be and the thing is that the real estate business and the finance business and everything associated with the construction, renovation, all that sort of stuff, it's probably close to 25% of our economy. So if there's a downturn, even a small downturn in that sector, would be enough to tip the country into recession. And it wouldn't be because people decided they don't want to buy homes anymore. It would just be because they couldn't qualify for the mortgages at the current interest rates. That would be the simple story right there.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, the big problem in real estate right now is all those empty office towers across the nation. Any hope for them? Will they have to be torn down and rebuilt as something else?
You know, we just had a meeting this morning, actually, with our head of our company, and he's really putting a push on to have people return to the offices. He feels that the collaboration and working with other people in person is much better than working at home and going on Zoom calls occasionally, that sort of thing. But and part of that is because our firm decided to renovate all the houses, all the offices across Canada. So he's made a pretty big investment in that. So he wants to get a return on his investment. But on the other hand, it seems like an awful lot of people prefer working from home. I'm pretty much working from home. Like, I go into the office for meetings like that, like I had today, and I know I had one yesterday, but maybe only 2 or 3 days a week. And I don't even really need an office in the office. I just need a desk I can plug my computer into. So what I'm trying to say is there's a bit of a pushback, but the trend seems to be in place that there'll be fewer people going to the office every day, for sure. And a lot of the employees are demanding it. I talked to a guy recently who said that the first question in the odd job, they were looking for an employee, and pretty desperate to get one, and the first question was from the employee side was, can I work from home? And if the answer was no, that was the end of the interview right there. The better the people are, the more negotiating power they have. So these surplus office towers, which is what the question was about, are going to be surplus in Vancouver and Calgary, they're talking 30% vacancy. I don't know, maybe not in Vancouver. Vancouver, Calgary for sure, 30%. Same in Edmonton, 30%. But that's vastly understated because, for example, a lot of these leases are 15-year leases, and most of them are at least 10 years. So if the company that signed that lease for 10 or 15 years is only half using that space, or in our case, probably less than half using it, it still counts as fully occupied because they have a lease. It's good for another few years another 8 years or 10 years. It's only the stuff where the lease is expired and they can't you can't find new people to move in that is counted as vacant. So it's way more than 30% because there's all kinds of companies that are in that situation where they've got twice as much space as they need or three times as much space as they need. They may still need space, but if most employees are staying home, I've heard that, sort of like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, the offices are looking somewhat full, not as full as they were prior to COVID, but, maybe three quarters or something. But they're empty on Monday and Friday. So that's already 50% less occupancy than we had before. So if that's the case, then there's way too many office buildings. And I saw just in the news today, I think it's been in the news, and I've written about it, I think. But the Brookfield has defaulted on three. They're the largest office tower landlord in Los Angeles, but they're also a huge landlord in Calgary and Toronto and New York and the Wall Street lower Manhattan and in Canary Wharf in near London, England, they've defaulted on three buildings now. So the top building in Los Angeles is now in receivership because Brookfield walked away. Now, they they put equity in there. I don't know how much equity they put in. And then they took out a loan for the balance, $200 million loan or something. I don't know what the ratio was. But the lenders they can't come after Brookfield. It's called non-recourse lending. So Brookfield can walk away from it, stop making the payments, and they lose title to the office tower. But they're not on the hook. The lender can't come after them for the deficiency. So if the office tower was thought to be worth $500 million downtown Los Angeles, and it ends up, the lender and the receiver end up putting it up for sale and end up getting $200 million for it, they lost $300 million. Brookfield is not on the hook for that, unlike a homeowner who would be. So they walked away now from three buildings in downtown Los Angeles, and I think you'll see more of that. And that's so the next time. So there's a ripple effect, though, because so then they can't avoid, once you have a receiver, once you have a bank, you know, a lender sells it, and you know, just put it on the market, just get rid of it, you know, whatever I could get for it. So they sell it, and they say, to use that example, the $500 million becomes $200 million. Well, all the office towers in Los Angeles have to be reevaluated at the lower price, and that'll have a ripple effect through private equity, through pension plans, through all kinds of people that own those kind of assets. That you know, those big office towers were a favorite for pension plans, certainly the. The building that our office in Edmonton is called Manulife, and it's definitely an insurance company that owns that one. So it'll have a big ripple effect throughout the pension plans, like Ontario Teachers. They've been reporting great results, but they have less than half of their money in publicly traded equities. They have most of it now is in private equity, direct ownership of real estate, all these private things. And the thing with those private things is, who knows what they're worth? You don't really know what they're worth until something like this happens, where somebody defaults on the office tower and it has to be a reevaluation of the value of it. So that's coming, starting right away. It's already started, and there's going to be more of that. So I don't know. It's like the other thing that about these office towers is, can they be repurposed to residential? And you'll see articles almost daily now. You see articles of talk about that, and the problem is it's extremely difficult. I saw an article recently said that we should just demolish them because they're not really. It's very difficult and expensive to convert them to residential. The plumbing is all different, the electrical is all different, the heating, everything is all different. It's not the same kind of construction at all that you would do if you started out to build a residential building. So maybe it's better just to tear them down or demolish them and build a brand new residential building instead.
Well, they did repurpose the old BC Hydro building in downtown Vancouver into condos. So that was a successful conversion as far as we can tell. But as you said, Hart, I did see a little documentary about someone's developed. It's almost like putting a camper inside your office building, like little residential units that would
imply. Yeah, pods.
Yeah, pods. And you had Elon Musk who wanted people to, you know, sleep under their desk. Well, I could see the attraction of a building that was two-thirds residential, a third office block. So you literally could live near work, just walk down the hallway, jump in an elevator, and you're at work. So there you wouldn't mind so much not working from home.
Yeah, but you know those people that are living there. Where are they going to take a shower? Where do they, you know, what bathroom do they use? What? You know,
well, like but that, they're all in the pod, right?
Yeah, but they have to find it. You know, and most office towers only have two bathrooms: one for the men, one for the women, and they're not heavily used the way home bathrooms are. Yeah. So, it would even get so far as to if you took all the office towers in downtown big million person city and converted them to residential tomorrow, the city would have to redo all the sewers and everything underground. Like it's a big thing. And that's and on top of that, of course, is maybe people don't want to live downtown. You know, converting to residential, you're assuming that people actually want to move downtown, and that certainly isn't the case in Edmonton and Calgary. People, there was quite a push on for condominium living in downtown a few years ago, but seems to be fading. People are not that excited about the idea of living downtown anymore.
Whereas in Vancouver, because of the West End, we've always had heavy residential downtown usage. The streets of Vancouver don't just roll up after 6 o'clock at night.
Yeah, no, Vancouver is special. Once you get a certain threshold amount of people in on the streets in downtown, then it's much safer. The safety factor is much better and all that sort of stuff. It's just these office, you know, if you got a downtown of a bunch of office towers and you try and put a few residential things in there, people don't feel safe in that environment because it's not a good situation. There's not enough people. Everybody leaves at 5 o'clock or nowadays they don't even come at 8 o'clock in the morning and nobody comes downtown. The place is empty. Now you're living there and you think, oh, I don't know if it's safe to go outside or not. Yeah. So.
Hilliard, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, I just wanted to mention, you know, we've talked over the years about Tesla a little bit, and I just wanted to mention that for Canadians, I saw an interesting piece of news that, Tesla has a factory in Germany and a factory in the U.S., several factories in the U.S., and they have one in China. So the most popular model now is called the Model Y, which is kind of like an SUV, a small SUV based on the Model 3 platform. And they are manufacturing Model Ys in Shanghai, which is where the Tesla factory is in China, and putting them on ships and sending them to Vancouver, British Columbia. So there's three ships. There's these people that watch everything that Tesla does, right? And they've identified three container ships full of cars, Model Ys, somehow they've determined it's Model Ys, heading for Vancouver, and they're about to arrive. So if you buy a Model Y, now, I don't know, does Tesla tell you if it was made in California or Texas or Nevada or Shanghai? I don't know if you get that information from them, but I suppose if you asked, they would tell you. But and are people comfortable with having cars made in China? I guess we buy all kinds of stuff made in China, and it seems to work. So maybe we'd be okay with that. But that's the new thing. And another company, BYD, based in China as well, is really big in electric cars now, getting bigger and bigger all the time. They're sort of rivaling Tesla now in China. It's shipping cars now to Europe, to Germany. Imagine a Chinese company shipping cars to Germany, the headquarters of Mercedes and Porsche and Volkswagen and Audi, and it's sort of boggles the mind to think that could happen, but that's what's happening.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Nice to chat with you.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. Check out his website, MacbethMcLeodPartners.com. You can find him on Twitter at HMacBE. If you have any questions for Hilliard or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Find us on Twitter at HowStreet. We're on BitChute. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.